Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about The Red and the Black, Chapter 23, Part 1. Geronimo is fun. Swim said the mama fishy said, epigraph, casti, Italian, oh man, I can't say anything right tonight. Epigraph, casti, Italian poet, satirist, and author of a comic opera librettos. Very cool. Laura Weistich said, right where we stopped reading today, the structure became quite confusing, jumping from one character to another. Sometimes this book is a bit difficult. I thought it was funny that Julian assumed Madame de Renal must have someone else just because she was being cold to him at the start of the chapter. Yeah, I know. They're so insecure at that bit. He jumped to that conclusion. He leapt to that conclusion. And regarding the difficulty of the structure, yeah, it was a bit funny because it was a character in the story speaking, and in that, what he was saying is he was telling a story. So the narrator of the book had a character speaking, and that character was then narrating a story himself, and within that story other people spoke, which usually you would punctuate with quotation marks and then double quotation marks to show that, you know, it's a quote, like the person who's speaking is quoting someone else. But being that this book doesn't have any quotation marks in it, it's completely without any sort of grammatical syntax to show you who's talking and who's quoting whom. So it was in a couple of bits a bit confusing to know when, you know, someone speaks and then it goes back to the narrator. Is that going back to the character who's narrating, or is it going back to the narrator of the book? So yeah, it was a bit hard. But yeah, it's just purely down to the decision to not use grammar, I suppose. And some authors do that really well, and they pull it off completely seamlessly. You don't even notice that there's no quotation marks in the book. Parentheses. But not in this case, because, yeah, like you said, it was confusing, and there were some bits where you had to sort of iron out the kinks a little bit mentally to figure it out. So a bit of a fail there, I'd say. It was possible to figure out. It was just a bit confusing. Altreat said, morosely he recalled for Francois first pretty lines, and which to him were completely fresh, because only a month ago had Madame de Renal taught them to him. And then how many oaths, how many caresses, contradicted every single line. Women change their minds. Trust them if you're blind. Why do you think Madame de Renal wanted to teach Julian these lines? I also thought the narrator's musings on how places governed by elections like New York had the great misfortune of not being able to escape from people like Monsieur de Renal, and how public opinion is a frightful thing in a country that has a constitution. That's my phone, by the way. Beep beeping. Are petty people, Stendhal's words, really harder to escape from with democracies, republics, than under a monarchy? I am dubious. Also, she would have sacrificed her life without hesitation to save her husband's, and she had seen him in danger. All the same, there had been deadly days when she could not keep from picturing the enormous happiness she'd taste if, having become a widow, she was able to marry Julian. Poor lady is all twisted up. All twisted up indeed. All right. Wasn't too many comments on today's chapter, so we'll continue reading. Let's have a little look-see. I'm just having a quick squiz. There goes my phone again. Oh, God. Oh, no, I've lost my page. Okay. Oh, that's not too bad. About 5 pages. Sorry. Phone down. Just checking my phone mid-podcast because I'm a professional. All right, let's keep reading. Hey, this is part two of chapter 23. The autumn and some of the winter passed very quickly. It was time to leave the woods of Vergy. High society in Verrieres began to feel indignant that its anathemas made so little impression on Monsieur de Renal. In less than a week, a number of solemn personages, who rewarded themselves for their habitual gravity by the pleasure of running errands of this kind, implanted the cruelest suspicions in him, though using the most circumspect phrases. Monsieur Valenod, who was playing a tight game, had obtained a place for Eliza in a noble and very respectable family, where there were five women. Eliza, fearing, as she said, that she would not find a place for the winter, had asked this family for only about two-thirds of what she received at Monsieur the Mayor's. On her own initiative, this girl had come up with the excellent scheme of going to make her confession to the old curé Chelan and to the new curé at the same time, so she could tell both of them the details of Julien's love affair. At 6 in the morning, the day after his arrival, the abbé Chelan spoke to Julien. "I'm not asking you anything," said he. "I beg you, and if needs be, will order you to say nothing. I insist that within 3 days you leave for the seminary in Besançon, or for the house of your friend Fouque, who is still willing to offer you a magnificent future. I have anticipated everything, arranged everything, but it is essential that you go on and do not return to Verrieres for a year." Julien answered, "Not at all." He was considering whether his honour ought not to consider itself offended by the pains that Monsieur Chelan had taken on his behalf. After all, he wasn't his father. "I'll have the honour to visit you again at the same time tomorrow," he at last said to the curé. Monsieur Chelan, who counted on being able to take a high hand with so young a man, said a great deal more, but taking refuge in the humblest bearing and wearing the humblest expression, Julien did not open his mouth. Eventually he left and hurried to warn Madame de Renal, whom he found in despair. Her husband had just been speaking to her with a certain degree of frankness, the natural weakness of his character, bolstered up by the prospect of the inheritance from the Besançon, had determined him to consider her as perfectly innocent. He came to walk about the peculiar state of public opinion he had encountered in Verrieres. The public was mistaken, led astray by envious people, but what should they do? For an instant, Madame de Renal had the fantasy that Julien could accept Monsieur Valenod's offers and remain in Verrieres, but she was no longer the timid and simple woman of the previous year. Her fatal passion and her remorse had made her more lucid. Soon, as she listened to her husband, she felt the sorrow of knowing that a separation had become inevitable, at least for a time. "Away from me he will go back to those ambitious plans that come so naturally to one who possesses nothing. And as for me, great God, I'm rich, uselessly so for my own happiness. He'll forget me, lovable as he is. He will be loved, and he will love. Oh, miserable woman, but what am I complaining of? Heaven is just. I did not have the virtue to forego my sin, and my judgment deserted me. It only needed me to bribe Eliza onto my side. Nothing could have been easier for me. I failed to take the trouble to think for a moment. Wild dreams of love occupied me wholly. I am doomed." Julien was struck by something when telling Madame de Renal the terrible news of his departure, that he encountered no selfish objections. It was obvious that she was holding back her tears. "We need resolution, my friend." She cut off a lock of her hair. "I don't know what I'll do," she said to him, "but if I should die, promise me you won't forget my children. Far or near, try to make decent people of them. If there's another revolution, the throats of all the nobility will be cut. Their father might well flee abroad because of that peasant who was killed on the roof. Watch over the family. Give me your hand. Farewell, my love. These are our last moments. Having accomplished this great sacrifice, I trust I will have the courage to look to my reputation in public." Julien had expected despair. The simplicity of this leave-taking moved him. "No, I'll not receive your farewells like this. I will leave. They would have it so. You wish it yourself. But 3 days after I've left, I will come back to see you in the night." Madame de Renal's existence was transformed, so Julian truly loved her. He had himself conceived the idea of coming back to see her. Her racking pain was transformed into one of the most vivid sensations of joy she had ever felt. Everything became easy for her. The assurance of seeing her lover again deprived these last moments of their power to harrow. From then on, Madame de Renal's behaviour, like her features, became noble, resolute, and perfectly conventional. Shortly after Madame de Renal came back in, he was beside himself. At last, he told his wife about the anonymous letter he had received 2 months before. "I mean to take it to the casino and show everyone that it's from that infamous Valenod, the man I raised from beggary to become one of the richest citizens of Verrières. I'll shame him publicly, then I'll fight him. It's become too much. I could become a widow, great God," thought Madame de Renal. But almost at the same moment, she said to herself, "If I don't prevent this duel, as I certainly can, I will be my husband's murderess." Never had she worked on his vanity with so much skill. In less than 2 hours, she made him realize that he must show more friendliness than ever to Monsieur Valenod, and even take back Eliza into his household. Madame de Renal needed courage in resolving to set eyes on the girl again, the cause of all her pains. But the idea came from Julian. At last, having been set on the right path 3 or 4 times, Monsieur de Renal came all by himself to the idea, financially most troublesome, that what would be the most disagreeable of all to him would be for Julian, in the midst of the stir and gossip of all of Verrières, to settle there as tutor to Monsieur Valenod's children. It was obviously in Julian's interest to accept the director of the poorhouse's proposals. It would, on the contrary, redound to Monsieur de Renal's own glory if he should leave Verrières and enter the seminary at Besançon, or the one at Dijon. But how to convince him of that? And then, what would he live on? Realizing the imminence of a financial sacrifice, Monsieur de Renal was in even greater distress than his wife. For her part, after this conversation, she was in the state of a sensitive man who, tired of life, has just taken a dose of stramonium. He acts only by reflex, so to speak, and takes no interest in anything. Thus, Louis XIV, as he lay dying, found himself saying, "When I was king." A wonderful remark. As soon as it grew light the following day, Monsieur de Renal received an anonymous letter. This one was in the most insulting style. The grossest epithets applicable to his state leapt from every line. The work of some envious underling, this letter forced his thoughts back to a duel with Monsieur Valenod. Very soon his courage mounted to the point of thinking of immediate action. He left the house alone, went to the gunsmith to secure some pistols, and then had them loaded. In reality, he said to himself, "Even if the Emperor Napoleon's severe administration were restored to the world, I personally do not have the sou's worth of pilfering to reproach myself with. I may have more or less closed my eyes, but I have some fine letters in my desk authorizing me to do so." Monsieur de Renal was terrified by her husband's cold rage. It brought on again the fatal imaginings of being a widow, which she had fought off with such difficulty. She shut herself up with him. For several hours she talked to him, to no effect. The new anonymous letter had decided him. Eventually she succeeded in transforming the courage needed to administer a slap in the face to Monsieur Valenod into that of offering Julian 600 francs a year for his maintenance in a seminary. With 1,000 curses on the day he had had the idea of taking a tutor in the house, Monsieur de Renal forgot the anonymous letter. He consoled himself somewhat with an idea he did not mention to his wife. With a bit of management and availing himself of the young man's romantic notions, he hoped to persuade him, and for a lesser sum, to refuse Monsieur Valenod's offers. Madame de Renal had much more difficulty demonstrating to Julian that in sacrificing the 800-franc engagement publicly offered to him by the director of the poorhouse to her husband's convenience, he could accept compensation without dishonour. "But," said Julian again and again, "I've never had, even for a moment, any intention of accepting those offers. You've made me too accustomed to a life of elegance. Those people's coarseness would kill me." Julian's will was bent by the iron hand of cruel necessity. His pride supplied the illusion of accepting the sum offered by the mayor of Verrières solely as a loan, and he made out a note entailing repayment over 5 years with interest. Madame de Renal still had a few thousand francs hidden in the little grotto on the mountain. She tremblingly offered these to him. feeling only too sure that she would be angrily refused. "Do you wish to make the memory of our love abominable?" he said to her. At last Julien left Verrieres. Monsieur de Renal was very happy. At the crucial moment of accepting money from him, Julien found the sacrifice too difficult. He refused point blank. Monsieur de Renal embraced him with tears in his eyes. Julien had asked for a certificate of good behaviour from him, and in his enthusiasm he could not find terms grand enough to exalt his conduct. Our hero had 5 louis in savings, and counted on asking Fouque for a matching amount. He was greatly moved, but by the time he was a league from Verrieres, where he was leaving so much love, he thought only of the joy of seeing a capital, a great military town such as Besançon. During this short absence of 3 days, Madame de Renal was taken in by one of love's cruelest illusions, because between herself and the final unhappiness there was to be this last meeting with Julien, her life was tolerable. She counted the hours, the minutes that separated them. At last, during the night of the third day, she heard the agreed signal from far off. Having gone through 1,000 dangers, Julien appeared before her. From that moment, she was to have only one thought. "It is the last time I shall see him." Far from responding to her lover's eagerness, she became like a scarcely animated corpse. If she forced herself to say she loved him, it was with an awkward manner that almost indicated the opposite. Nothing could distract her from the cruel idea of the eternal separation. The suspicious Julien thought for an instant that he had already been forgotten. His irritated words to this effect were received only by great tears flowing through silence and almost convulsive squeezings of the hand. "But, great God, how do you expect me to believe you?" Julien responded to the cold protestations of his lover. "You would show 100 times more sincere feeling to Madame Derville, to a mere acquaintance." Petrified, Madame de Renal could only reply, "It's impossible to be unhappier. I hope I shall die. I feel my heart icing over." These were the most extended responses he could get out of her. When the approach of day made his departure necessary, Madame de Renal's tears suddenly ceased. She watched him fix a knotted rope to the window without saying a word, without giving herself up to his kisses. In vain did Julien say to her, "We've come now to the condition you have so ardently wished for. From now on, we live without remorse. You'll no longer see your children at death's door as soon as they have the slightest indisposition." "I'm upset that you aren't able to give Stanislav a kiss," she replied coldly. Julien ended by being profoundly impressed by the absence of warmth in the embraces of this living corpse. He could think of nothing else for several leagues. His soul was riven, and by passing over the mountain, as long as he could see the bell tower of the church in Verrieres, he kept looking back. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Thank you very much for listening to that, and I'll see you tomorrow.